thanks very much. The first few minutes we can have direct questions straight to him on what he said, if necessary. And after a few minutes, you can come in with perhaps a bit longer contributions of your own. Question there.
Yes, if you take this no money producing for needs effort, okay, and you're not a self-sufficient country, how do you resume trade with other countries? Any trade?
Yeah. Yeah, the means of wealth production and distribution aren't in this country. In Britain, couldn't survive on this country's alone, on this country's means of wealth production alone. That's why we talk about world socialism. Can't have socialism in one country for that reason. Exactly. Capitalism exists throughout the world now, including the state capitalist dictatorships, Russia, China. And so we're not going to trade with anybody. We're going to cooperate using the advanced technology we have for communication.
You mean we're going to have an import ban like Socialist Works Party suggested?
On the contrary, we're going to have anything. We're going to, you know, anything but. We're going to have the free flowing of wealth across the world on a quantitative basis. You know we can feed the world now. Wheat producing fields are being took out of production in America now. You've seen the stockpiles of food in the European economic community. And in other parts of the world, arable land isn't being used. In Ethiopia, incidentally, arable land is being used for coffee and tea production because it makes money. Workers are starving over in there because arable land is all took up by these cash crops. And I was listening the other day on the radio. Eddie Sharp is opening a... He's not a favourite with trade unionists, but he's going to start a new national newspaper, and he's going to put the newsprint, you know, he's going to type it in, I forget the exact words, use an electronic typeset. And instead of...
Where is he getting his finance from, man?
Instead of the Fleet Street newspapers, getting it all done, you know, typeset and now using old methods and then distributing it from London... Some do it from Manchester as well. He's going to transport the newspapers along a little minute wire in the form of an electrical signal. These are going to go direct to the other end, direct to computers, you know, straight onto the printer, simple as pie, and then they will be able to distribute from local centres rather than from more centralised. That's how socialism will work on a decentralised basis.
Right, next question.
You mentioned that there are enough houses to go around for everyone, and that we see lots of houses advertised all the time. The big problem is that apparently the working class cannot afford these houses. But surely it's very much the same situation with jobs. We see millions of jobs advertised in the newspapers all the time, but yet. Workers are without jobs, surely it's the same sort of thing. In fact, there's not enough houses to go round. What you're saying is that there are enough houses.
Yeah, there is. By the way, on the jobs bit, vacancies in job centres are about 120,000, something like that. There's 20 people chasing each job. You know, this is a slump, a capitalist recession. As for houses, there's currently a brick surplus. They produce more than they can sell. The biggest ever runs in something like 57 million bricks, something like that. Yet we've got approximately 500,000 workers in the construction industry are on the dole. They are not needed to build houses. Yet we can see that the need is there. There's homeless people. I'm one of them. I'm living in a bloody poxy bedsit. I don't like it. I want a house. Why can't I have one? I can't afford one. Why can't I afford one? I haven't got a high paid job. There's no jobs. Wage slavery isn't a good thing to have anywhere, even when you have a job. House building annually has fallen to its lowest level since the early 30s. There is no demand for houses, according to the capitalist way of seeing their economics, you know. Yes, there is a demand, but there's no demand for profit. It's not the workers' fault. It's the capitalist system. It's not our system. It functions in their interest.
In the front.
Yeah, well, I shall fire two torpedoes from my submarine. Well, once they do, though. The first one is this. Now, I used to live in London. I used to live in Earls Court. And in those days, it was the land of the Aussie. It's now the land of Casablanca. That's the first thing. The second thing, I used to work in Hyde Park. And I often used to go and have a drink up what they called the Queensway in Lancaster Gate. Well, I haven't been up there for 10 years. I went up there the other day, I brought a camera. I thought I was in the Casbah. Now, that was 10 years. I haven't been up there for 10 years, the Queensway, because I don't live in London now. But I completely transformed that place. I thought I was in the Middle East. But anyway, that's one thing. That's the first thing. You can understand why there's a certain prejudice in a capitalist society, because you have all these groups of, or ghettos of, what they used to call it with the Jews, of various types of people, or ethnic groups, which are there for their own interest to try and make money and get by the best they can within the capitalist system. And of course, it usually rubs shoulders with another group or ethnic group that doesn't quite get on with them for their religion or their colour or something. That's the first thing that causes friction. Now, you're on about the state capitalism of the Soviet Union. I think of the glorious Red Army. I can think of them now taking Berlin. I can think of the 20 million that died defeating fascism. Now, I don't want to think that they died in vain. I know a lot of other people died fighting fascism of other countries, but the Russians contributed the greatest amount of the Second World War. And I'm not saying it's a perfect system, but what was it like in 1939 in those countries that are now occupied by the Soviet Union? What kind of governments did they have then? I'm thinking of Admiral Halsey in Hungary. I believe he was a kind of a fascist. I'm thinking of Romania. I'm thinking of that weird Colonel Blink in Poland. I'm thinking of a few others in Czechoslovakia. They weren't exactly star turns, were they, in the 30s? The governments that were running those countries before the Red Army liberated them from the so-called Third Reich. And that's the question. You've been knocking them.
No, I don't mind you knocking them. Can you hear the question at the back?
You knocked them. I don't mind you knocking them, but you knocked them too hard.
Well, I'm going to knock them as hard as I can on every opportunity I get, because I would say, like I said before, capitalism exists across the globe. And the Soviet Union is acting like every other nation in the capitalist economic structure. It's acting like an expansionist capitalist nation who tries to get its footing, get its economic interests in the door in every way and everywhere it can. Russia in Afghanistan, it's just what Britain were in Afghanistan before that, many years ago. What are they doing there?
Well, I can answer that.
There's lots of rich resources there, strategic position.
But it also was a feudal society in that case.
Did you let him finish first?
Well, it's just,
I don't want to interrupt here, but
it's just
feudal.
You know, if Russia wants to build up capitalism in them countries, that's Russia's concern. It benefits from that. It's got nothing to do with socialism. And we don't support it. They're just constructing a very efficient dictatorship, most efficient way of running wage slavery. And it's got some of the lowest wages in Europe and Russia as well. But there's been, you know, there's been instances of liberated countries going on to act in this way. After shaking off their colonialists and their imperialists, they've become imperialists themselves. USA, China, South Africa, near but few, you know. The thing is, you don't advance towards socialism by strengthening capitalism. And no extension of Russia is going to benefit the working class. It benefits Russian capitalism.
Right, anybody else with a question they'd like to put? Show it back.
Russia is self-sufficient in all the resources what a country needs to survive very well. Oil, food, wheat, etc., etc.
Wheat.
I come up wheat.
You have been recycling.
Come up wheat. But most things, why can't that set up socialism? on their scale. You know, not just Russia, but all the fascist so-called Marxist countries.
Well, like I said before, the means of world production and distribution aren't. You've got to look more closely than what appears on the surface, you know. Look closely at the trading in the Financial Times, for example, of the Russian Comecon countries. They're all over the globe. They don't pay too much attention to nationalism, by the way. They've got the finger in the pie all over the place. But they want, you know, they import shiploads and shiploads of wheat from America, to name one thing. And they want, especially the Russian workers, more and more things, which we have the opportunity to get in this country. We haven't got the money to get them, but we've got the opportunity to get them. We look in the shop window. But they want Levi jeans, they want, you know, latest fashions and all the rest of it. You know, Chairman Mao and his way, they all go along in that one fashion, the old grey suit. But no, it can't be self-sufficient. Never has been, never will be.
And the next one. I'll give him priority here to people not associated with the Socialist Party. Anybody wants to come in and put a question?
I enjoyed the remarks of the speaker very much. You brought to mind some of the examples of the more idiotic ways that we're encouraged to look upon society. You know that sort of thing where you sit in front of the news and the newscaster says that there's been a terrible plane crash disaster and 400 people died and two of them were Britain, and they spend the next 2 minutes saying about particular two people who were British, or there is a coach crash involving children from where was it, St Albans, and your attention is drawn to that. Now I can see that of course there is a reason for giving priority to that sort of information, because people who are close to them are living in this area. But what I think it does to distort the way that we look at the world, and consequently the way we organise the world, is that it has this idea, you know, of putting in our minds the idea of Britishness before anything else. But most importantly, the idea of putting forward Britishness before class. Because it puts this idea, doesn't it, that you know, your country is more important than your class. So although it's in fact the case that I've got much more in common, probably along with most people in the room, with my sort of counterparts in Russia, China, France, all over the place. I might not speak their languages, but my lifestyle and my conditions are make me have more in common with them than I do with English-speaking people who've got British written on their passport, who are in fact members of the ruling class in this country. And I think the idea, one of the most dangerous aspects of nationalism is the way that it conceals the real interest that we should be identifying, a class interest, a global interest with workers all over the world. The old idea that workers have no country, that we've only got a class. Because I think they're all skin talking. It's interesting to know that when they talk about these plane crashes, some sort of sci-fi, really, they talk about these plane crashes and so many people died, related as a disaster, which of course it is. But if they were to report on the number of people who also die unnecessarily each day through unnecessary malnutrition and starvation, what you'd have is Alistair Burnett and his friends coming onto the television every single day of the week saying that yet again another 82 plane loads, 82 jumbo jet loads, 747 loads of people have died, not actually in a plane crash, but because they had insufficient food. And if you divide the number of people starving in a year by 365 and work out the number of seats in a 747 I sat down a couple of weeks ago and did, you'll find that 82 planes crash, starvation planes crash, as it were, every day, people from all over the world.
Right, I'll take that as a general point rather than a question. One or two more points, if you like, before we move into the second half of the meeting. There's one in the middle, and then we'll just begin with that.
Yeah, I'd just say, one, I wonder if people would like to comment on a recent event, that's the Belgian disaster. And I had the feeling that behind that, there was some sort of gung-ho nationalism, perhaps. I wonder if you could comment on it.
Well,
football hooligans. Most of them, by the way, come from the lower rungs of the ladder of the working class. In fact, they're not hooligans, in fact. They're human beings responding to their environment and their society. They were, I don't call them yobs. They're potential comrades, as far as I'm concerned. Their only way of expressing themselves, really, in society, because they haven't got the opportunities that other workers or, you know, other young people have for a niche in society, you know, a job with status or a well-paid job so they can have a car or something really flash. They express their status and their individuality by machoism. Displays of drinking 20 pints in one night, and I can be more nationalistic than you, and we're better than them, and this is all geared into it. Egged on, by the way, by the jingoists, who, you know, the Falklands War was madness, wasn't it? You know, Britain's going to do this, our boys, and let's get one over on them. The football commentators as well, have you heard them? They really go over the top, don't they? Talk about bias last night. You know, that's sport for you. It's being twisted into us and them. Not a natural game of football. But there's always been football hooliganism, by the way. It's not a new thing. But it takes on more extreme, hard forms because the new generation tries to outdo the older one. The status game. And all this bit in the football stadium in Brussels was just an extension of all this, you know. They've been nurtured by capitalism to behave in this way. And capitalists don't like it when they do it.
What about the Chinese guy?
Chinese capitalists. There's a privileged parasitic class out there as well. They get the best holidays, best houses, and best everything. I'm sure somebody else can comment on the Brussels one as well.
All right, thanks. Now, there was another point at the back. Is anyone who hasn't been in?
I'm coming with a point, yeah. Try and be fair about it. If not, back at the back.
I'd just like to come back on a point I made earlier. All the communist countries didn't spend their capitalist money on arms, etc. Spend most of the money on, I should imagine. Biggest time in the world. Surely, if they spent their money on producing wheat, etc., in the communist countries, they will be self-sufficient. So why, the point you made earlier about Ethiopia producing coffee and other things, rather than producing the stuff they need, wheat, for instance, why can't they set up a socialist state in the whole of communist countries? Surely they can, if they didn't.
Get
what I mean?
Yeah, I understand what you mean, and I'm quite sure, I don't know anything about the agricultural conditions in these countries, but I'm sure that would be a barrier to producing a lot of things, even if they did want to produce it. But the thing you've got to really remember is study the mode of production, not what people say they like or whatever. They must have a big army to protect what they've got from predators. Like I said before, they're acting like any other capitalist country. The Bolsheviks in the 1917 revolution might have been sincere or not, so I'm not bothered. The fact of the matter is, they were doing it without the material conditions to do socialism. There wasn't a majority of socialists who wanted to establish world socialism. So they must operate as a consequence of that. What can you do? You can build up capitalism.
Where is socialism going to begin? That's what I want to know.
With you!
That's it.
One minute.
No, where is it?
It's not us or Russia.
It's going to be begin in Britain, and then the Russians will.
Well,
you can't get the whole of the world.
Why not?
Well, I think I know the point you're getting at. Yeah.
It's got to be built from somewhere. It's got to gather ground.
Yes.
You can't just write the whole of the world.
Well, you could say, in the present conditions, it's not going to come from Ethiopia, is it? Or Bangladesh? You can hypothesize, you know. Theorise about this and that, but the fact is, the means of world production in the leading advanced countries, Britain, America, and all the rest of it, we could have a socialist society on that basis. But the main thing is, the majority of people consciously wanting it and understanding why they want it. And that needs people who, you know, understand why it's in their interest to cooperate. That is the thing to go for.
Unless you've got a majority of people who are prepared to cooperate, there's going to be no socialism. And that was missing in the 1917 revolution, regardless of the wishes of the Bolsheviks. They set themselves up as leaders, and when they got there, they wanted cooperation. You don't get socialism by leadership. You get it by cooperation. We are a cooperative party, democratic. Join us, socialism will be nearer.
But I'll just point out, before I take the next point, I'll just point out in relation to the last question, your information, that the Socialist Party does have companion groups in a number of different countries. So from that point of view, what we're saying in relation to your question is that it can and must develop in different parts of the world at the same time. Obviously, each party in different countries will not be identical at a given moment in its numbers. There'll be one party which is bigger than another. But we do already have a movement in a number of different countries. You've got details of this in the literature we've got over there, where we're trying to build up a movement, not just in one country, but in several. Now, I think there's a point right at the back.
If you talk to the average worker in Russia, or to the average worker in Poland, one of the things that you'll notice, and incidentally I've done this, is that such a person is, generally speaking, going to come out with the same sort of nationalist view as the average worker in this country. In other words, you know, if you talk to a worker in Russia and you say, why have you got an army? Why have you got bombs? Are you prepared to blow up the entire population of New York or London? You know, like the civilised, well-educated people at the Young Conservatives rally before the last election, when, you know, the intellectual advisor to the Conservative Party, Kenny Everett, got up and said, let's bomb Moscow. And all these Young Conservatives cheered, you see, because they've been to Eton and Harrow and these sort of places where you learn sort of civilised behaviour. Well, if you... they're in favour of blowing up the entire population of Moscow. Men, women and children, who incidentally don't even have the chance to elect the dictatorship that's doing the dirty work. Now, if you talk to the average worker in Russia, he'll say, well, we need a strong police force. We need a strong army. You talk to the average member of the Tory party. The average member of the Tory party would get on very well. If you sent along a bloke like Jaruzelski to the Tory party conference, Jaruzelski would go down better with, you know, the Cecil Parkinson. You know, with a man as well as a woman. He'd go down very well. Mind you, you know, there's a rumour that Cecil Parkinson went down pretty well with both, actually. But the point is, or maybe they brought in Selwyn Gummer to redress the balance. The thing is, you know, when it comes to it, though, you know, they would love Jaruzelski or this new man, Mr. Gorbachev. You know, incidentally, he's a flashier dresser than Norman Tebbit, and he's got much clearer ideas on how to handle the working class. And Mr. Gorbachev would come along to the Tory party conference, and all of these, you know, these people who never do anything for the rest of the year, they go along to the Tory party conference every September in order to clap. It's every October, in fact. They go along and they clap, and it's the greatest amount of effort that they ever put in to any activity during the year. They clap every time the word Britain is mentioned, you see, or our country, every time the nation is mentioned. They clap, you see, because, in fact, they are the missing link between the apes and the rest of human beings. That's why they spend most of their time banging their hands together. It's a primitive form of human activity. Now, the thing about it is that, you know, these people don't think there's a big difference. So if you go along to the Labour Party, and the Labour Party calls itself a Socialist Party, if you go along to the local Labour Party branch in Islington, where all of the so-called, you know, people who the Islington Gazette are very frightened about, the Islington Gazette frightened of anything, you know, the Islington Gazette would be frightened if they heard feudalism was on the decline. If you actually go along to the local Labour Party in Islington and you said to them, we want to do away with Britain, Britain doesn't actually mean anything to us, you know, let's disband Britain, it's not worth it, it's worth as much as Rockall, you know, forget about it, it's a rock, it's just a bigger rock, we inhabit, Rockall is inhabited by one idiot, who's sitting on it, you see, phoning his wife every so often. You know, I read in The Guardian this morning, the educated newspaper, that the man on Rockall phoned up his wife. You know, he's left the SAS, he's gone to live on a rock. Which is fair enough, you know, you think join the SAS, you involve all the gunfire, fighting terrorists, all the rest of it, you get brain damage eventually, you've got to live on a rock in the middle of Well, if you actually go along to the local Labour Party and say, well, look, Britain is just a bigger rock. And if you were standing up on the moon and you tried to, you know, pee down on Britain, you'd probably hit Paris anyway. So you forget about Britain, it's not significant. The average member of the Labour Party would be very shocked. because, you know, Neil Kinnock is a very patriotic man. Neil Kinnock believes that, you know, the British people should come first. Mr. Gorbachev believes the Russian people should come first. Mr. Reagan believes the American people should come first. And when it comes to it, you know, the point I'm making is workers all over the world don't even own a rock. You know, you don't own Rockall. You know, you don't own... There's another way of rock. You know what I mean? So when it comes to it, what I would say to you, and you'll find this when you watch this film, you know, and some of you, I'm glad, some of you have come here to watch a film and you've arrived early, so you've got to listen to the discussion as well. Because, so, you know, socialists don't run a television society. We appeal to the brain as well as the people looking at screens. So what I would say is, bear in mind, the average worker does not own any country. The average worker doesn't own a city. Most workers don't own a house, and if they do, they're just going to end up sort of paying back the money to the building society when it's time for them to buy that funeral, which is the next big investment they're going to go in for. So just bear in mind, workers don't own anything. And if any worker in this room are, how much of Britain do you own? I would imagine if all of us put together all of the amount of Britain that we own and put an advert in classified section at the end of the Guardian, it would cost us more. It would cost us more to, you know, buy a half page in the Guardian to sell our share of Britain than we'd get for the share that we own.
Right, well, thanks very much. Now, that being a bit hard to follow, we'll pause on that note.